This is Fresh Air. The latest entry in the growing list of TV news magazines is Day One, anchored by Forrest Thoyer. We used the debut of the show as an occasion to invite him to talk with us about his career in journalism. Sawyer used to substitute for Ted Koppel on Nightline. He reported from the Middle East for 8 months. During the Gulf War, he broke the Pentagon's policy on pool reporting and traveled independently with his crew and satellite dish. Sawyer started his network career at CBS, where he hosted a morning show with Maria Shriver. I asked Forrest Sawyer if he was nervous when he first started anchoring Nightline.
Scared to death. One of the earliest shows, a wonderful ABC News producer named Rick Kaplan, who now produces Primetime, who came to me only a month after I had been at ABC and said, come on over and do Nightline. I said, you know, you really can't do this to me. I'm scared. I can't. He said, that's all right. We'll book flights to four different locations under assumed names for you the next morning. You're going to be all right. And I shortly thereafter did a program on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And to show how good Rick was as a producer, they did this tape. And we had Mr. Khrushchev's son and the son of somebody else from Moscow. And I went to Mr. Khrushchev's son, and he had trouble speaking English. He began talking in Russian back to me. So I said, well, I'm hurting here, but I'll go over to the next guy. And I asked him a question, and unfortunately, he stuttered. So if I hadn't had Robert McNamara there, and all you have to do is say, Mr. McNamara, can you give me the history of the Cuban Missile Crisis? I'm going out for donuts. I would have been in terrible trouble. But Rick was able to cut that together and actually make it look like I wasn't a complete fool.
Many people singled you out for outstanding reporting during the Gulf War. Did you volunteer for the assignment?
Did more than volunteer for the assignment. I was a tremendous troublemaker over there. I hated the pool system. If you remember, the pool system was the way the military would round people up and allow them to go where they wanted them to go. And they'd pack a little field lunch for you. And it was like going on a school trip. Take you to the library and you get to talk to the people they wanted to talk to and bring you back. And I thought that wasn't news. That was public relations, and wanted to go out on my own. Unfortunately, Bob Simon and his crew had gotten picked up by the Iraqis at one point, and so everybody became very nervous about letting us go out on freelance runs or without the representation of the military there. You were subject to being arrested if you went beyond 100 kilometers. But I was rabble-rousing and saying, you know, we got to go. And finally, in fact, Ted Koppel lobbied to allow me to go for his broadcast, and we put on chocolate chips, those camouflage outfits that they wore in the desert, so that mm-hmm. we had a vague appearance like soldiers. And we sneaked through the checkpoints. I had managed to map all the checkpoints and finally made it to the front and got some interesting pictures and first pictures of deserters and those kinds of things, which proved that it could be done and set the ground for us to be able to go out with a satellite.
How did you sneak through the checkpoints?
Kind of with attitude, just sheer attitude. I'd put on my military hat and kind of wave through and act like I was in a rush and had somewhere to go, and we had a sand-colored truck and just bluffed our way through. They could have stopped at us at any point, and we'd wound up in the brig.
So you were passing yourself off as a military man?
I was not. I never said I was in the military.
No, but with the attitude you were giving was a military attitude.
Well, the attitude I was giving was that I was in a rush to get somewhere.
Right,
now,
okay.
If the military are in a rush, that's not my fault.
So these were American checkpoints?
Only a couple had American there. Happily, most of them were Saudis.
Mm-hmm.
And the Saudis thought that if they saw an American dressed like that with attitude, he must be in the military.
Yeah, because I'd imagine if there were American checkpoints, people would say, hey, there goes Forrest Sawyer. I mean, that's a problem you could really run into when you're trying to slip unnoticed and you're actually very well known in the country that you're from.
Well, not with sunglasses and a three-day-old beard.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to look more like Robin Williams after a couple of bad nights.
So your editors at ABC finally supported you in breaking away from the press pool?
They did, and we went out and got what I think was a terrific story, which was the first television report from the front itself, and the first pictures of the actual air bombing that was going on, and some Iraqi deserters, just by sheer happenstance, drove up to the earth berm where we were situated, right on the front, and gave themselves up in front of our camera. It was just sheer luck. And so when we went back with that story, we had a lot more opportunities to go out on things like I went out with the Saudis in an F-15 on a bombing run and just operated entirely outside the auspices of the U.S. military.
Were there any guidelines that you followed for traveling independently and trying to keep safe?
It's real tricky because you can get into all sorts of situations. The only guideline that I would follow, I was traveling with my satellite dish during the actual ground war. I was traveling with six people. And I would have meetings, basically. I'd pull them all together, the satellite guys and my crew and a producer. And I'd say, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to literally drive into Kuwait City, and it's going to be dark, and there are going to be Iraqis there, and it could be unpleasant. Anybody who doesn't want to go doesn't have to go. And I would lay out the risks involved, and there's simply risks. You can't get around that.
What were the risks that you laid out?
That we could get killed, that the Iraqis might grab us and throw us in prison, or they might shoot us, or they might steal our truck and leave us out in the desert, or we might even run into friendly fire. I mean, we were running out there by ourselves. And what we actually ran into in Kuwait City, by sheer luck, I mean, most of this is luck, as we were driving around the city late at night, and passed a number of Iraqis who were trying to wave our truck down so they could grab it and make a run for them. A white Mercedes stopped, and right in front of us, two guys with submachine guns got out and said, "Are you with the Americans that I just brought in?" And I said, "Excuse me?" And he turned out to be from the Kuwaiti resistance and put us up at his house and wired us right into the Kuwaiti resistance. So within a matter of 2 hours of getting into Kuwait City, I knew everything that had been happening there from the Kuwaiti side.
Yeah, I guess that's the kind of serendipity that helps so much in a dangerous and unsure situation.
It's luck and opportunity, those two things, and you know, chutzpah at some point.
Journalist Farah Sawyer is my guest. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Farah Sawyer is my guest. What was your timing? When did you decide this is the moment for us to try to get into Kuwait?
Well, I had originally decided I thought the war was going to last longer than it did. I thought it was going to be at least a week. And I thought gas would be used. Gas could be delivered by artillery, probably not by Scuds. So Scuds didn't bother me. But if you went to the front and you were facing artillery shells, then there could be some problems. So I went around way to the west with the Arab forces where I thought there would be strong fighting. Instead, everybody gave up. They just started pouring in. It was a very surreal scene, walking in this cloud of smoke, dropping their weapons and their gas masks and holding their arms up and saying, "Please give us food." And it became very clear that we had to get Kuwait City fast. And I was in the wrong place. And I also had a truck that didn't work. It had broken down. So we were in terrible shape. And I went over to a guy who was with the U.S. Special Forces, an advisor to the Saudis. And I said, "Oh, I got to get to Kuwait City. You got to help me out here. What can I do?" And he said, "Well, you can stay with us. I believe we'll get there about August, the way we're going." The Saudis were not moving fast. They stopped. They'd have tea. They'd pray. He said, "Or you can just cut across there. That's a shortcut, but I believe the landmines will get you. Or you can go all the way back into Saudi Arabia and take a left turn and go all the way back on the east side," which is what we wound up ultimately doing, going into a little town. I begged, borrowed, and stealed a truck there from a guy who ran a baby products store. I promised him my firstborn, my producer, anything he wanted, and then just made a screaming run at about 100 miles an hour for several hours to try to get into Kuwait City when we finally got there.
Who did the driving?
Well, there was a convoy. There were four trucks, but I drove one of them. I drove the lead truck.
Mm-hmm. So you're good at driving 100 miles an hour?
When I've got Rune Arledge back in the United States. Yes, I do. Rune Arledge is the president of ABC News, and he's much more terrifying than the Kuwaitis.
So did you expect did you expect to get to Kuwait ahead of the American troops, or was that just luck that you beat them?
When I started out for the run, it didn't make any difference. I just had to get to Kuwait City, and I had gotten a pass from the head of the Arab forces, a piece of paper saying that I could have my satellite dish, which meant I was unarrestable by the Americans. They couldn't pick me up. I was traveling with a free ride. So if the war had lasted longer, I would have been able to just roam anywhere that I wanted to. And I got to a certain point, and somebody or other told me that CBS had already gotten there and was reporting, and then an hour and a half, 2 hours later, I got there and started reporting, and the luck of it was that we got to the Kuwaiti resistance first.
Mm-hmm. So when you got to Kuwait, what were the first things you wanted to show Americans?
First things I wanted to know were what's happening to the Kuwaiti people, how many Iraqis are still in town, who's in control of this city, what are you doing for food, and those kinds of immediate questions. After it began to be settled that the Iraqis had either fled or were being picked up by the Kuwaiti resistance and the Americans and the and the Air Forces were beginning to move in, I think a day and a half, 2 days later after I'd gotten there, the next questions were, what happened here? And I began moving toward the issue of atrocities, mm-hmm. and ran into a number of, one wonderful doctor who had risked his life with a little tiny camera that he kept hidden in his hospital. And whenever a victim of atrocity was brought in, he and two other doctors would smuggle his camera out, snap a photo at the risk of his life, at the risk of torture, and then try to hide the camera somewhere back in the hospital. And this went on the whole time of the occupation, and he came to me and he said, I've got this film. Can you develop it for me? And I took it to, I believe, Associated Press, and I said, really important film, guys. Can you develop it? They did, and it was all fogged.
Mm.
All the film was bad, and so he had risked his life finally for naught, and he just broke down and cried. But those kinds of things, it was just one thing after another of seeing what the city had gone through. And then, quite frankly, I saw the horror of watching the Kuwaiti resistance, whom I had come to admire very much, being pushed aside by the government that had been living in Taif in Saudi Arabia at a 5-star hotel and came frolicking back into town and just disregarded the Kuwaiti resistance, the ones who had kept people alive and fed and with contacts to the outside world with their own satellite phones, just pushed them aside and took back over again. And now Kuwait is as it was before, which is not such a pretty place.
Right. Farah Sawyer is my guest, if you're just joining us. I'm interested in finding out a little bit about your own background. I know your father was a career naval officer. Did you grow up on military bases?
In my younger years, lived in Jacksonville when he was at the Jacksonville Naval Air Station. However, when I was about 8 years old, he had finished up his 20 years and decided he would like to go to my mother's parents' farm in Central Florida and be a farmer, because he would be on his own then and wouldn't have any bosses like he'd had in the military all that time. And knew nothing about farming, unfortunately. We became known as the single most unsuccessful farming family in Polk County's history. There's a plaque to us somewhere in the town.
Did you like living on a farm? Did you find it boring, exciting?
It was my mother and father and my brother and me, and I truly hated it. We really were the most unsuccessful farming family in Polk County. That's not a joke. But we would put up fences to keep our Angus cattle in, and they would just walk through the fence. they would laugh at us on the other side.
So what were your passions in your younger years?
Trying to avoid hoeing the orange trees. I got really good at hiding in various places and kind of doing a low crawl to my room. Sports and girls once I hit puberty.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read that you were a class president in high school. Did you ever want to be a politician?
No, not after having been class president. That was bad enough. More importantly, I was a disc jockey in high school in my junior and senior years, which is a far better thing than to be a class president, which is kind of a nerdy thing. Being a disc jockey at, handling the 10 o'clock shift on a Friday or a Saturday night is extremely cool when you're in high school.
Okay, now in college you majored in Eastern philosophy and world religion.
Now it's turning ugly today.
Wait, you and I know that the people who are the real career achievers do not major in Eastern philosophy and world religion.
I know. I don't know. I was heading toward the monastery and took a wrong turn, and I'm here now.
You weren't really heading toward the monastery, were you?
No, I was just interested in how other cultures thought. You know, this is the 60s, and I was wandering around and occasionally going to the anti-war rally and wondering what the heck was going on here. And I was really interested in Buddhism and Hinduism, and particularly interested in Mahatma Gandhi.
It does seem like an odd choice for somebody who ended up in such a high-pressure profession.
I guess, but, it allows me to remain calm in the center of the storm.
Right. And then you were going for a doctorate in wildlife management. So
see,
how did you end up in TV?
Isn't this just incredibly silly? I don't know. Everything went blank. The truth is that I had been broadcasting for a long time. I'd put myself through college in radio.
Oh.
And I was a sort of journeyman radio type whenever I needed to be. I loved going to study various things. I studied all kinds of things. And whenever I needed money, I could just get a job in radio.
News radio, rock and roll radio?
All the above. I got into journalism at a certain point and probably didn't go back.
So how did you get from radio to TV?
I did a lot more interviews than you do in a single day. I did 8 per day, live. and was just getting blind from trying to do all that studying and, mm-hmm. and know what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I was a little bored mm-hmm. From the constant rotation of things. And so I decided to do a Sunday talk show or something on the local stations. You know how horrible they often are? It's just terrible. They're sitting around in uncomfortable chairs talking about city taxes. And I said, you can do better than this. And they gave me an audition. And instead, they offered me the 11 o'clock anchor job. Now, had I known what I was getting into, maybe I would have gone to the monastery instead. But it ultimately worked out. It's just hard to figure out television. It's weird.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Terry.
Farah Sawyer anchors Day One, a news magazine on ABC, broadcast Sunday evenings. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.